In 1843, a Scottish woodturner named Daniel McNaughton walked up behind the secretary of the Prime Minister, Robert Peel, on a street in London and shot him in the back of the head. It's still uncertain whether McNaughton thought he was actually killing the Prime Minister rather than his secretary, but either way, the PM secretary died later of his wound. When McNaughton appeared in court the next morning, he is reported to have said, "The Tories in my native city have compelled me to do this. They follow, persecute me wherever I go, and have entirely destroyed my peace of mind. It can be proved by evidence. That is all I have to say." McNaughton was eventually found not guilty by reason of insanity and was sent to the infamous Bedlam Lunatic Asylum. The case created a public furore and led to the House of Lords raising a number of questions about the case. The reply from the court's Chief Justice helped form what later became known as the McNaughton Rule. To establish a defence on the grounds of insanity, it must be clearly proved that at the time of committing the act, the party accused was labouring under such a defect of reason from disease of the mind as not to know the nature and quality of the act he was doing, or if he did know it, that he did not know that what he was doing was wrong. In Western legal systems, these ideas are well entrenched in our understanding of crime. We have basically agreed that some people are not responsible for the crimes they commit, most notably children and the mentally ill. But today on the Philosopher's Zone, we're going to ask when we should and when we shouldn't take the blame for the crimes we commit. Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and I'm joined this week by Anthony Duff, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Stirling in the UK. Professor Duff has worked extensively on legal philosophy, particularly trials and criminalisation, and he's in Australia at the moment. Anthony Duff, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you, it's nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the McNaughton case. Here, both prosecution and defence argued on the basis of insanity, but the prosecution said the accused was only partially insane and still knew the difference between right and wrong. The defence said that McNaughton's delusions had led to a breakdown of his moral sense and a loss of self-control, which according to medical experts had left him in a state where he was no longer a reasonable and responsible being. The conclusion was that he had lost all restraint over his actions. Now, this is possibly slightly circular. We're being told that a person who is reasonable and responsible does exercise restraint over his actions. If we accept that not knowing the consequences of your actions is a reason for acquittal, there are, of course, motives to feign insanity, and it's been argued that McNaughton, who was a political radical, had been financed to assassinate the Prime Minister and subsequently feigned insanity. So, even here, there are difficulties, aren't there?
There are indeed, yes. I think the issue of feigning is a separate issue, which we can leave aside for the moment, and partly because the effect of being found insane, after all, is not freedom, but detention in an asylum, which is often no more attractive than detention in prison. So the issue of feigning is a further question. But as to what it is that might be feigned, you're right, McNaughton, at one level, was committed murder. He intentionally killed a human being, and he knew he was doing that. And that fits the law's definition of murder. The law also, of course, provides defences against a charge of murder. For instance, if you kill in self-defence, then you can be acquitted. But McNaughton's belief that he was being persecuted could not ground that kind of defence because his life wasn't in danger, even given his own beliefs. So on the face of it, he was committing murder. The question is, though, whether he was, as you say, a responsible agent at the time. Because when the law defines murder, it presupposes some notion of responsible agency. So if a responsible agent intentionally kills, then that's murder. In a similar way, when you look at cases of children who commit crimes. A tragic case in Britain some years ago now, when two boys aged 10 and 11 killed a toddler of three.
This is the Jamie Bolger case, yes.
In one way, what they did fits the definition of murder. It's not clear they intended to kill. They intended at least to harm him seriously, and that's enough for murder in English law. But again, we need to ask whether there were, at that time, responsible agents who could be held to blame for what they did. Now, in Norton's case, the key point is that his belief that he'd been persecuted wasn't just a mistaken belief, it was a delusion. Which is to say, in being gripped by that belief, he wasn't responding to the kinds of evidence or reason which are relevant here. So he had lost touch with the realm of reasons in holding that belief and in the way that belief informed his actions. And that's to say, he wasn't, in that respect, a responsible agent. He wasn't within the realm of reasons within which agents operate rationally.
But responsibility involves intention. Now, McNaughton said, "I was driven to desperation by persecution." And when pressed, he said, "I am guilty of firing." So it looks as though he did intend at least to pull the trigger, and presumably he knew what the consequences of pulling the trigger were likely to be. Isn't that enough to establish intent, and isn't that what matters, despite his deluded state?
Certainly he intended to kill, and he knew he intended to kill, and he knew in a way what killing was. He didn't think he was killing a monster from outer space. He knew he was killing a human being. But I say that's enough to establish guilt and blame if you're dealing with a responsible agent, and that's the key point. Because to convict a person of murder is not just to say, as a matter of fact, this person intentionally killed another. It's to condemn the person for doing what they could and should have seen they had good reason not to do. If McNaughton was gripped by a delusion, if his world was structured by this delusion of persecution, so all he could see was enemies around him, if it was a delusional state, he had lost his grasp of the reasons which should normally guide action. So intention is enough for guilt, only given a background condition of responsible agency, or capacity to understand and to be guided by the reasons which should guide our actions. And that's where McNaughton, he wasn't an extreme case, just because he was in a way in touch with the world. He knew this is a person he was killing, he knew he was firing a gun and so on. But still, if you look behind the action to what motivated it, you find a person who's lost touch with the world around him and lost touch with the realm of reasons and values which the law presupposes. And that's why he should be acquitted.
When did we first start to see reason, or being a reasonable person, come into the picture of criminal responsibility, the idea that you needed to be a person who could reason or be reasoned with?
It goes back at least as far as Aristotle in the 4th century BC Greece. If you read Aristotle's writings on ethics, he's clear that responsibility is required for both moral and legal punishment, and that involves capacity to engage in reasoning. Of course, what changes through time is our conception of what counts as rational capacity, what it is to be reasonable. But that you need to be reasonable to be held responsible for your actions is again, it goes back at least 2,000 years.
So the notion of what constitutes reason, or what is a relevant conception of reason, that has changed over time.
And that's still controversial. Take the case of psychopathy. It is still deeply controversial. A psychopath is often described as a person who can be intellectually very acute. They're very good at working out, at planning crimes, committing crimes, seeing how to do what they want to achieve. So in terms of pure cognition, they seem to be eminently reasonable. But there's something deeply missing in their lives, a whole dimension of emotional effect. They are unmoved by other suffering. They don't have the kinds of emotional capacity which we think people need to have if they're to survive, if they're to live as human beings. So we do ask the psychopaths, are they responsible agents or not? Do we say, look, they're responsible because they can reason? They're also deeply unpleasant people because they don't have the emotions which people normally have. Or do we say, which I would say myself, that emotional lack is itself a rational deficiency. They can't understand what they're doing because they can't grasp that emotional dimension to their actions. But the point is that we can agree that what matters for responsibility, and thus for criminal guilt and moral blame, is how far the person is rational or reasonable. Where we sort of disagree deeply is what counts as being rational or reasonable, what's required for that, and how far that's a matter of pure intellect, or how far that's also a matter of certain kinds of emotional capacity to grasp that dimension of our lives.
Well, I think it's interesting that you suggest that there might be an emotional lack, because this does imply that the qualities that you need to possess in order to appear in the frame, as it were, in a court of law, are not purely intellectual. They can also be emotional.
That's right, yes.
So is it possible to establish, as it were, a sort of checklist of qualities that we can tick in order for somebody to be accused of a crime?
People try to work out checklists, e.g. for psychopathy. There's a very complex checklist. And if you score above 30 on the 40-point scale, then you're said to be a psychopath. That's, I think, always bound to be rather crude. What we need to ask of each defendant is, could this person understand what it was they're said to have done? Not just as a factual matter, that I killed someone, that I stole their money, but could they understand the way in which that is a wrong they've committed against another person? And there are various ways in which they might be unable to understand it. So you can ask about, the simple questions are whether they could grasp the facts of the matter. It's hard for me to say, what is it to understand the moral dimensions of what you've done? And there, I think, in the end, although you can get checklists which kind of summarise what we find out, in the end, the only way to establish that with confidence is to talk to the person and try to work out whether you can engage this person in genuine conversation about what they have done. Or do you meet a kind of blank wall when they can't understand what on earth you're talking about? And that's often very hard to determine, especially in the context of a court of law or a police interrogation. But that's what matters.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Professor Anthony Duff from the University of Stirling about legal responsibility. Anthony, you've mentioned reason, you've mentioned emotion. There is something else, which is imagination. I can imagine that you've already mentioned the Jamie Bulger case. It occurs to me that both the accused in the Jamie Bulger case might have measured up reasonably well on grounds of reason, ability to reason, and also they might have measured up reasonably well on emotion as well, but there was an imaginative failure on their part to realise what they were doing, which might or might not have been to do with their very young age. So you need imagination, don't you, in order to grasp what it is that you're doing and what its consequences will be?
Certainly, I think that's important about the Bulger case, that they knew that they were doing something very naughty. They knew they were hurting this young child. If we ask, did they understand that they were killing him? Could they grasp what it is to kill someone? That seems to me much more dubious that a child of that age could have that kind of grasp, as you say, an imaginative grasp, of what it is to kill someone. But if they couldn't grasp that imaginatively, then it's hard to say that they're murderers. They have indeed killed someone. Of course they have, and that's a terrible, terrible thing. But could they understand the nature of that wrong? It seems to me probably not. And one more point, too, which I think is relevant here. The sight of those two boys in an adult court being tried, there's something grotesque there. Because to be put on trial is to be called to answer for what you have done, called to account by your fellow citizens, by the court. But to be called to account, suppose you could understand what you've done as the wrong you're charged with doing. You could understand what it is to commit murder. I think those boys couldn't understand that dimension of what they'd done. So to try them as if they could understand it is grotesque.
Well, it did occur to me that if you could have children in the dock, why can't you have children in the jury?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things about the Bulger case is that it's clear from the public response that many members of the public in the UK didn't think that they lacked various capacities. They blamed them, and they blamed them very, very seriously. So clearly there are different views within the community about what constitutes responsibility.
Yes, and I think that the reaction to that kind of terrible, terrible killing is partly that we're so gripped by the horror of what was done. It's hard then to retain a sense of the person who did it as other than a monster. I think it's very tempting, and you see this in a number of high-profile, terrible cases where it's not so much we hold the person responsible, but we see them as a monster. Anyone who could do that is a monster, who's therefore to be expelled from the moral community almost. So I think it's not so much that they held the boys responsible as responsible agents, but they saw them as moral monsters. And that seems to me, in a way, a natural but deeply worrying reaction.
And presumably, if you see somebody as a moral monster, you think it's whatever this person has done, this person would be capable of doing again, which might be one of the reasons for public interest in the recent child porn accusations against one of the boys.
Certainly, yes. It goes further than that. It's not just they might do it again, but as a monster, they're no longer one of us. They're no longer part of our moral communities. So we see them as dangerous beings against whom we need to defend ourselves by detaining them or whatever, but not now as members with whom we engage in a moral life. And that kind of exclusionary move towards those who commit terrible crimes is all too familiar.
Let's return to the question of mental incapacity. The legal scholar Leo Katz from the University of Pennsylvania has pointed out that you could have a mental illness, but that the illness might not be relevant to the crime you've allegedly committed. He cites an example of someone with an illness forging some documents concerning a disability pension. That person is mentally ill, but does being mentally ill absolve that person from responsibility?
No, there are so many different kinds of mental illness, many of which are partial rather than total. They don't take over your entire life. In one area, you're not a rational being. But in other areas, you're still perfectly competent. So if I suffer from a compulsion of some kind, that would affect one area of my life quite drastically. But in other areas, I'm still a competent, rational being, and I'm therefore blameworthy for what I do. So what needs to be shown is either the person was so mentally disordered that their entire life was distorted, or alternatively, that their mental disorder did indeed bear directly on the crime they committed. That's clearly true of McNaughton, but that does need to be shown, certainly. So what undermines both criminal liability and moral blameworthiness is that the wrong you committed flowed from your mental disorder.
To take a rather different view of punishment, which is the deterrent idea, it could be said that if the justification for punishment is its deterrent effect on the rest of the community, then the punishment of the mentally ill, providing, I suppose, that they're not recognised widely as mentally ill, will have just as much deterrent effect as the punishment of the sane, and is therefore justified.
Of course, because deterrence operates, as you point out, by being seen to apply to those who are thought to be guilty. So those who might commit crimes fear that if they do commit crimes, they'll get punished, and they see people being punished. So what matters for effective deterrence is perceived guilt rather than actual guilt. And so certainly you're right that if we punish those who are mentally ill, that might be, in terms of pure deterrence, rather effective. And furthermore, if we allow no kind of defence of insanity, that then will increase the certainty of punishment and make it even more effective as a deterrent. You can't hope to get off by an insanity plea. So if punishment were pure deterrence, then you're right, insanity wouldn't be a defence. But that seems to me one way of showing what's wrong with that view of punishment. Because think what it is to punish a person who is so disordered they can't understand what's been done to them or why. They're there suffering in prison and they don't know what's going on. There's something grotesque about that is a way to treat a human being. If that's what deterrent punishment commits us to, then that shows what's wrong with a pure deterrence theory. Of course, most of those who think punishment is deterrent don't think that's all that matters. They think it must also be justified by the person's own guilt as a constraint on the deterrence.
Just finally, you've said that the idea of what it is to be reasonable or rational is still controversial. So what are the current philosophical debates or questions about responsibility that legal philosophers are grappling with? Is there contested ground here?
Oh, plenty, yes. Okay, one set of issues, which I mentioned before, concerns the dimensions of responsibility, how far, for instance, it is a matter of emotional capacities or how far it's a matter of something more intellectual. And that's one range of debates, for which psychopathy is a prime example, the debates around psychopathy and whether it is or is not a genuine mental illness. At a deeper level, there are still debates about the relevance of issues to do with free will and determinism. Some would say, look, if you look at the developments, especially recently in neuroscience, we show more and more of how the brain works, of how actions depend upon this or that kind of neural functioning. What's being revealed there is the ways in which our actions are not our own actions, but are determined by prior causes. And what's being revealed then, some would argue, is that the whole notion of free will and thus of responsibility is a myth. If they're right, of course, then that undermines the whole enterprise of criminal law as a matter of determining, ascribing responsibility, and upholding people to account as responsible agents. My own view is not that pessimistic. I don't think neuroscience in that way undercuts responsibility. It shows us the mechanisms of human agency and human thought in a very important way, but not in a way which undercuts our view of ourselves as responsible agents who can operate in the realm of reasons. But that controversy about free will is still an ongoing controversy and has been for 2,000 years and more. And that bears directly on the notion of criminal responsibility. The question is, does the law presuppose a notion of free will, which is untenable? Some would say, yes, it does, and that's what undermines the legitimacy of criminal law.
Some would say that what? That it totally undermines the legitimacy of criminal law? I mean,
criminal law as an enterprise of holding people responsible for their actions. They would say, I guess, we can have something else which takes over from criminal law as a matter of trying to control conduct to prevent harm in certain ways. But if punishment is seen as an enterprise of condemning those who deserve to be blamed because they have done wrong as responsible agents, some would argue that that whole way of understanding ourselves is illusory.
If you could make changes in criminal law regarding criminal responsibility, would you do so, or would you leave things as they are?
I think we operate with a fairly crude set of ideas of responsibility, as Anguish again shown in the Bilger case and in other cases, which is especially difficult when you're dealing with dramatic high-profile cases of terrible killings, when it's very hard to keep a grip on the idea that perhaps the offender, the person who did the killings, is not a responsible agent. So I'd want to have a more sensitive set of legal criteria. So I don't think there's anything deeply wrong with the law's criteria, certainly in Britain, of responsibility. They recognise or can recognise the ways in which people can fail, can be unable to understand what they're doing. And I think, too, it's right that it's quite difficult to show a person not to be responsible. We should assume responsibility, assume the person is a responsible agent, until it's very clear that they're not. But as always, the law's not always as sensitive as it could and should be to the more nuanced kinds of incapacity.
How would this sensitivity operate in a court of law? Because within our legal system, both in the UK and in Australia, we have an accusatorial system, which means essentially that the trial is a sort of drama, it's a stage play. How can you inject greater sensitivity into the scenario of this play?
Partly by more resources, of course. What you need is the time and the space for each of the adversarial sides, defence and prosecution, to articulate the story they're telling about the crime, to explain how they see the defendant and what the defendant did. And that requires the time and the space to work through the competing stories, to give the jury a time, and I think the jury is important here, to grasp themselves what's going on and what the competing narratives are. So it's part of a matter of just enough resources to have the time and space to do this, and enough witnesses available who can examine, talk to the accused, and then produce an account of the accused's condition.
Well, Anthony Duff, thank you very much indeed for joining us this week.
Thank you.
Anthony Duff was in Australia to deliver the 2010 Simon Veil Lecture on Human Value. The show is produced by Kyla Slavin. The sound engineer this week was Judy Rapley. I'm Alan Saunders. And if there's any justice, I'll be back next week.
On the health report, how your hip bone's connected to your heart bone, how your heart bone needn't be connected to your mouth bone, and a way of preventing weight gain in young women.
Previously, we've always felt that women in midlife around menopause were, you know, our high-risk target group. Now we're finding in this next generation that these younger women are gaining weight faster.
That and more with me, Norman Swan, and if you want to hear all that, why not download a podcast of the Health Report from Radio National's website.